It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
How much of a trendsetter is Bernie Sanders? He's now got primary opponents nodding along with him.
Please do not tell us that this is a rational healthcare system.
Right, right, right.
Kirsten Gillibrand later took the mic herself.
This has to become the next social safety net. It has to become something that is there for you no matter what. No matter if you can afford it, no matter where you live, no matter what.
And she's not the only one. Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker are also running for president using the new Sanders-sponsored Medicare for All as part of their platforms.
The American people want, and we are going to deliver, a Medicare for All single-payer system.
But candidate Amy Klobuchar is unconvinced.
This is a strong idea out there, but I've made clear what I think I'd like to do to get us to universal health care more quickly and to move more quickly, and that is to first of all put in a public option.
Medicare for All would mean nobody pays a premium or a deductible, and everybody is put under the government's care.
This would mean adding 180 million people to the Medicare program, and with the government takeover, we can see from other countries that we're going to have long wait times and rationing of health care.
Any questions?
This total transformation of health care would also wipe out private insurance companies.
Under Medicare for All, we cover all basic health care needs, so they're not going to be there to do that. I suppose if you want to make yourself look a little bit more beautiful, you want to work on that nose, your ears, they can do that.
So basically, Blue Cross Blue Shield would be reduced to nose jobs.
Something like that.
So this is the one jobs plan that just refers to nose jobs. And in the coming days, we should find out whether or not Medicare for All has more support in the Senate than the climate change addressing Green New Deal, which received 0 votes.
Well, nice to find a little bit of humor in that. Peter Doocy, leave it to him to do that on Fox News, a report recently. And now we're seeing that all of the Democratic candidates, at least virtually all of them, have embraced Bernie Sanders' so-called Medicare for All. Sounds great, doesn't it? Where you don't really pay and you get covered for everything and you can go anytime you want. And just think about it. Isn't it wonderful? You know, that's what it sounds like and that's what they want it to sound like. But of course, the reality is something quite different. Let me also add that Bernie Sanders' plan is in also the little untold part of this. It's not covering just citizens, but all residents in the United States. It also prohibits prohibits the government from denying benefits because of citizenship status. It also aspires to cover those who can't meet the loose definition of resident. So anybody that's present in the United States could get free Medicare under President Bernie Sanders and President Kamala Harris and President, you fill in the blanks, the rest of them. All right, so what is the reality here? Is it as good as it sounds? Or is there some sort of thing we're missing here? Well, I've asked the next guest to join us because she knows all about this. I've been talking with Sally Pipes. It's been a long time. But when she was in Canada as the assistant director of Canada's Fraser Institute, my son was in Vancouver. And we would talk on the air when I was in Chicago several times about what was happening in Canada and their healthcare system. But now Sally is in San Francisco. She is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. She's written all about healthcare. Her books are just, she wrote The Way Out of Obamacare. She wrote The Cure for Obamacare, The Pipes Plan with Ferregnery in 2012, The Truth About Obamacare. This is an issue which Sally knows well. Her little pamphlet we're going to promote today is called The False Premise of Single-Payer Healthcare. And she joins us this morning from San Francisco. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Sandy.
Hey, I just have to ask you, you know, when you write about something as much as you write about this, There must be something in your past or your history, your training, that has caused this to be a real hot button for you. What was that?
Well, as you had mentioned, I grew up in Vancouver, and I'm from Vancouver, and I'm an economist, and I started to work at the Fraser Institute, Canada's really only free market think tank. And in the late 80s, we started to see waiting lists develop for people trying to get appointments with doctors. The government had fully taken over the healthcare system in Canada in 1984. It started, the push for this started in some of the provinces, started really in the 40s with Premier Tommy Douglas. But, you know, the waiting lists were growing, and we thought we've got to look into this and see, you know, what's really happening. And because in Canada, under the Canada Health Act, no private coverage is allowed for anything considered medically necessary. And as a result, the demand for healthcare, you know, when people think something is free, is much greater than the supply. And the federal government had to limit spending to about 11% of gross domestic product on healthcare. And so as a result, when the demand is greater than the supply, you get long waiting lists, you get ration care, you pay hidden taxes. And so then in 1991, because I was so upset about what was happening to the healthcare system and things with my people in my own family and having a long time having to wait to get an appointment or having your care rationed, I had the opportunity to move to San Francisco and take over the Pacific Research Institute. And my mentor, Nobel laureate, the late, great Milton Friedman, told me that it would be that I should take over PRI. It's always good to be able to build up an institution. And he sent me a little map saying, and this is how you'll walk to work, so as to avoid thunder thighs and mountain goat calves. So that was my introduction to San Francisco. And I, you know, as soon as I got there was an initiative on the ballot in California, Prop 186, single payer, Hillary Care, then more things from Sheila Kuehl in California, then Obamacare. And now, of course, we're seeing a big push among the progressive liberal Democrats from Bernie Sanders, Pramila Jayapal in the House, and many others.
Well, let's take the 90,000-foot angle just for a second. Sally, it's hard for people to understand because this is so personal to them, and everybody wants good health care, and none of us don't want everyone to have good health care. But the way up high appearance of this, or from up high down low, the left really has a plan here. And by that, I mean the progressive left. I mean the socialists. This whole thing of health care is an issue that they always hone in on. What is kind of can you give us kind of a historical perspective on this?
Well, I think, you know, single payer Medicare for all, there are only three countries in the world that have true single payer systems, i.e. all private coverage for anything medically necessary is outlawed: Canada, Cuba, and North Korea. But, you know, members of the more liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders being the key, have been, you know, thinking about and pushing for Medicare for all, single payer, for several years, but it was never really in the mainstream. This, back in 2016, when Senator Sanders was running against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination for president, he really went out on the stump on single payer. He had a Canadian doctor, Danielle Martin, who campaigned with him and talked about the Canadian system. She even admitted that there are long waits for care in Canada. But that's when it started. And of course, Hillary got the nomination. Donald Trump became the president. But then back in 2017, Bernie Sanders introduced his Senate bill 1804, a Medicare for all bill, never, of course, saying how much it would cost or how it would be paid for. Then the 2018 election, the Democrats, you know, took back the House. The Republicans gained seats in the Senate, and Donald Trump is still the president. But he has been pushing this idea very hard, in 2017, 2018. And now with the new Congress coming in January, he has reintroduced his new Medicare for All 2019 Act, which is called Senate Bill 1129, which is even more comprehensive than his 2017 bill. But he didn't say how it would be paid for, how much it's going to cost. But we do know from Charles Blayhouse at the Mercatus Center and from Urban Institute that this, the 2016, his plan, and the 2017 bill were costed out at about $32 trillion over 10 years, so about $3.2 trillion a year, what we spend per year now on healthcare. But I think this new bill, S-1129, is going to be even more costly than his 2017 bill because it includes free long-term care at home or in a community hospital. And so, and plus he's adding in free dental, free vision, free drugs, free hearing. Those are things that aren't even included in Canada's very expensive single-payer healthcare plan.
Sally, you know what I just thought of? You probably know well that Bernie Sanders and his wife, they love Russia. They loved it so much they spent their honeymoon in Moscow during the Soviet years. It's a very bizarre story. He also loved Fidel Castro. But I think about Russia. I remember I was there for 2 weeks before the breakup of the Soviet Union. I did one very long interview with a Russian doctor and a Russian Orthodox priest. It was like stepping back in time across the table from somebody who stepped out of the 15th century, honestly. And we discussed at great length what was happening with healthcare in Russia. And at the time, it was just horrible is probably the kindest word I can think. Everything was filthy. Families had to come in and clean up the rooms. They had to bribe so-called nurses and doctors to even care for their families. It was really a shell of anything that was really related to true health care. And so I'm just thinking how ironic that Bernie Sanders, the boy fan of a communist socialism that led to that kind of health care, should be now foisting this upon the American people. The irony is pretty rich. But
Go ahead. Absolutely. No, absolutely.
Yeah, so, all right. So I want to talk to you. I want to do this. This is what I want to talk to you about. I'll just kind of tell you. I want to talk about the UK. I want to talk more about Canada. And I certainly want to come back home and talk about the United States. So maybe we have just a couple of minutes here before the break. Let's just talk in modern history, at least from my knowledge, the beginning of this so-called government health care was like the UK right after World War II. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, even, Prime Minister Winston Churchill had said at the end of the war that, you know, they needed a system of universal health coverage in Britain. It didn't, the National Health Service didn't come into being under Churchill, but he did plant that early seed, but it did come in under the Labour government. And the National Health Service this year in July will be 71 years old. And ever since it was instituted, there have been difficulties with finances, with, growing waiting lists, people being denied care. And today, under the National Health Service, the average wait for treatment are very long, 62 days on average after referral from a GP, for cancer treatment, 250,000 people in the UK waiting 6 months or more for treatment, 36,000 waiting 9 months or more. So, this system is not in the best interest of providing, universal health care, because government rations care and you get long waits, ration care, and it's expensive. This is not a plan that the American people would like. My mom used to say, I hope you're not becoming one of those impatient Americans. But how can you not? Because Americans are impatient, and I'm an American now.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. That's why you moved down, because you felt more akin with the impatient folk. The Americans certainly have taught the world how to do things efficiently. There's no question about that. That's because of freedom, the freedom of people to and competition to come up with a better way and compete with each other, nose to nose, in an honorable way. And we had a great health system. And what's going to happen to it, I'm not sure. My guest is Sally Pipes. And let me just say that her latest booklet is The False Promise of Single-Payer Healthcare. We'll put it on our Facebook page so that you can link to it and order it, because it's really a great little, like a primer on this whole thing. So Sally Pipes will join me in a second when we return. She's president and CEO of Pacific Research Institute. And this is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Mm-hmm.
There are between 80 and 100 babies born each month in Poplar. As soon as one vacates its pram, another one takes its place.
22 pregnancies. There's 24 of us all together.
24? The East End will eat her for breakfast.
Your comfort is not important. You have a job to do, and you will do it.
I can't believe you're a nun now.
I'm not a nun. I'm a nurse. People like you are supposed to help people like me.
There's more to me than work. I've had my share of adventures.
God love your innocence, Nurse Jenny Lee.
I can feel your end. It's shaking.
We're doing this together.
Help! Help!
Stick with me, love. I'm an old hand.
I didn't know people lived like this.
But they do. And it's why we're here.
Call The Midwife on BBC One and BBC One HD.
All right, that's kind of a fun little drop-in, but it actually helps people to understand kind of the genesis of all of this, at least in Great Britain. That was a trailer from a series on Netflix, with BBC production, called Call the Midwife. And it really established the very beginnings of the National Health Service in Great Britain. It talks about the conditions after World War II and the poorest areas of London, by the shipyards, where there was just no health care for women. And so it's a very compassionate show. Talks about these nurses who then joined this national healthcare force, and so did the doctors, and did their valiant best to give care to the needy. And I think when we think of nationalized healthcare, that's kind of what we have in our heads. Sally Pipes, but all is not what it appears. My guest is Sally Pipes, who is from Canada, but is now in San Francisco, and her little pamphlet is called The False Promise of Single-Payer Healthcare. She's written a lot of really full-size books, but this is kind of a primer that is very accessible for all of you to read, and we recommend it. Sally, I don't know if you've seen Call the Midwife, have you?
No, I haven't, actually. I just heard it, but I know all about midwives and their role in deliveries in the UK.
Yeah, well, let me just say the series is very sympathetic to helping poor people, and all provided by the government. So I would think that just as now, people then in Britain thought this was a really good thing, because these poor people can't afford any help, healthcare. And a lot of really good-hearted people who are Americans who feel the same way, we don't want people to suffer. But when did that break down from your perspective, Sally, that whole good, that nice notion, that wonderful notion that we could help everyone medically?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, people have to realize in the United States, it's not a free market in healthcare. We have our Medicaid program for people earning below 138% of the poverty level. We have Medicare for our seniors over age 65. We have the CHIP program for children. And, of course, we have the Veterans Administration for our vets. And, of course, that is a single-payer system. And in recent years, we've heard about all the problems of lack of access to care for our vets, because it is a government-run system. In the UK, the National Health Service, as I had mentioned, turned 71 this year. But, you know, the waiting times have got increasingly higher. When you have, you know, 250,000 people waiting for treatment in the National Health Service for 6 months or more, you have the accident emergency system, where the patients are, ambulances are supposed to be able to get into an emergency room within 4 hours of picking up a patient. They haven't been able to reach that goal. In recent years, only 84.2% of people are seen within 4 hours. And so they're looking at, of course, the solution with the NHS is we've got to, you know, get rid of that goal. If you look at cancer survival rates in the UK versus the United States, where the U.S. has the best cancer survival rates 5 years out in all cancers. But if you look at, say, prostate cancer among men, in the U.K., 83% in the U.K. survive 5 years. In the U.S., it's 97%. 81% of breast cancer patients in the U.K. survive 5 years. But here in the U.S., it's 89%. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, the government fully taking over the healthcare system, like it did in Britain. And in fact, Britain does allow private coverage. 10% of Brits have private coverage. And it's interesting that, you know, Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, who, you know, found out that he needed a heart valve replacement in April, he didn't, you know, head back to the UK to get his heart valve replacement. He went to New York Presbyterian Hospital and had it done, and it's supposedly successful. But I thought it was interesting, his younger brother, Chris Jagger, said, well, that Mick didn't have to, you know, he didn't got to wait in line at the NHS for his surgery. And in fact, you know, at the NHS, they work out under their NICE program, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. They figure out what is the value of your life versus the cost of your treatment. Now, in Mick Jagger's case, I'm sure he's worth a lot of money. But still, for a lot of people, if the value of their life is lower than the cost of having the surgery, you're not eligible for it. But, you know, but Mick Jagger chose New York Presbyterian. He could have done private in the UK, but I bet, I don't know, but I would think that he thought that in the US we have the most advanced treatment for cardiac surgeries. And so he was able to do that. So, but in the UK, you know, there's a shortage of 100,000 healthcare professionals. There's a shortage of about 41,000 nurses, 9,000 medical doctors, and the rest, you know, hospital workers. I think, you know, I keep thinking, Sandy, when you look at what the nurses union in the U.S. is trying to do, really pushing single payer, and particularly National Nurses United, if they love single payer, you know, why don't they go to the U.K.? There's a lot of openings, but, you know, the work is very hard and the pay is very low compared to what you get in the United States.
You know, when you talked about the quality of your life, the government assessing how, you know, really what you're saying reminds me, and I know this is the dirty word you're not supposed to ever mention, but it does happen to remind me of the Nazis classifying people in terms of their worth. I remember their phrase called, you know, they would say useless eaters. Some people were useless eaters. And they would classify the worth of people's lives. They, the government, would assign worth to people's lives. And, of course, we're doing that here in the United States in the sense of aborting, we don't have to get off on this, but aborting Down syndrome babies, like by the, I think it's in the 90th percentile, because their lives are not worth as much. So they get aborted, you know, routinely. So it's so dangerous, Sally, when somebody starts to arbitrate the value of life. But that's what you're saying. More important people get surgeries or don't have to wait as long in line. And not so important people might wait for too long. Really, they may not even survive till they get care. You know, I want to ask you this. I grew up in the American system, and I could say a lot about my own experiences before Obamacare and before, the corporate conglomerates that started to form, like in the 90s.
HMOs?
Yes, the HMOs.
Organizations, yep.
Okay, but so I'm curious to know, you as a Canadian who's an expert on this, as you were viewed our healthcare system, how would you have characterized it, and what did you see? Why did America do so well? Why is New York so famous? Why did Mick Jagger come there? What's the secret sauce? Why have we done so well with healthcare?
Well, for one thing, most of the research and development into treatment biologics and pharmaceuticals, all of that is done in the United States because most of these things don't pan out. They're very expensive to do the research. But at least in the U.S., there is a market for doing this, whereas in these other countries like Canada and Britain and France, they all have price controls on drugs. And so, and you just don't have the research capabilities. America has had this opportunity and allows innovation to take place, and people take advantage of it. As Frank Lichtenberg at Columbia said, for every $1 spent in newer pharmaceuticals, you save $7.17 in hospital costs. So, you know, if you have a gallbladder or whatever, you know, if you can have something done, you know, arthroscopically or treated through medicine and not having to have surgery, you know, it costs less, and it you're not taking a risk at having to have an anesthetic. But, you know, the U.S. has been, you know, I came because one of the reasons I came was I was so exhausted by the long waits and the ration care in Canada. And I thought the U.S., there are some problems, but I think that the healthcare system, the survival rate, longevity, all of these things, infant mortality numbers, you have to compare apples to apples, not, you know, apples to oranges. But I thought, it was the American system, you know, provided, you know, opportunity for people. And I definitely, you know, 180 million people in America have get their health care through their employer. Their employer gets, employees get their health care tax-free. Employers get to write off the cost of tax. One of the problems is that if you lose your job in the your employer-based job, you go out into the individual market, you have to buy your health care with after-tax dollars. So that puts, you know, people, I mean, I think is that we should change the tax code so that individuals can get their health care tax-free. I mean, in the first place, we never should have done this. This came into being in World War II when wage and price controls, or just after, when wage and price controls were in. It never should have been done. It distorted the market, but it is a fact of life right now. But America is where the innovation is done, and people come from all over the world to get their health care. But we need to have competition. People need to have choice in health care. When Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, says she's not in favor of single-payer Medicare for all, but she is in favor of building up on Obamacare, which is 9 years old, you know, if you're looking at things like a public option, she thinks there should be a government insurance plan to compete with private insurers in the market. Well, we all know there's a government plan in the exchanges under Obamacare that the private insurance companies will be ultimately crowded out, and we will be left in a single payer plan. She doesn't like short term limited duration plans. This was a rule that passed, that was introduced as an executive order by President Trump. But we need short term limited duration plans. We need association health plans. We need PPOs. We need HMOs. We need choice. That's what makes America great, so that people can get the kind of coverage that suits their needs and those of their family. Not a one-size-fits-all system where the government is in charge, just like it is in the VA, and where we will face long wait, ration care, a doctor shortage, and much higher taxes and new taxes to pay for it.
Yes, I often say, and I will say again, and I think I'm sure you agree based on what you just said, we should just turn this loose. When I hear, you know, where's the Republican plan, I think, forget it. Don't come up with a plan. Let the market jump in there, and they'll think of it. They'll innovate. They'll figure out how to do health care for all kinds of people, and they will compete with each other, and it will be better yet. And, you know, I was asking you what makes America's health care superior. I was thinking, you know, the medical device industry here takes a lot of hits. I recognize they've charged probably too much, medications too, but the other side of that is, you alluded to, in medications, all the innovations on medications that treat almost everything, and then medical devices and all of these huge machines that are available in hospitals that cost thousands and thousands of dollars that wouldn't be possible if your tax dollars were drying up because it was trying to cover everyone for everything. You would never have innovations like that, like the new mammogram machine, the new, you know, the MRIs, all, you know, just fill in the blanks. I'd like just your thoughts about that.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you look at Canada, where I'm from, the average wait today from seeing a primary care doctor to treatment by a specialist is 19.8 weeks. That's roughly 5 months. For some things, it's a lot longer. So if you have to wait 11 weeks for an MRI, if you think, you know, you might have, you know, cancer or a brain tumor, 63,000 Canadians cross the border every year, and now the estimate, I've seen some numbers up to 200,000 people leave Canada to seek treatment outside of Canada, and they're paying for it because they're worried about their health. So when you have the government in charge, you have these waits, and the thing is that in a country like Canada, the equipment, like the X-ray machines, the CT scans, the MRI machines, the positron emission tomography machine, that we really take for granted in this country. They're old in Canada, and in many cases, they're not even available, or just to a very few, because the government can't afford to replace all of this this equipment or get the latest equipment. So it puts your health at risk. My own mother, who died of colon cancer as a senior, when she thought she had colon cancer in Vancouver, she couldn't. She went to her primary care doctor. She had an X-ray. And I told her, you don't detect colon cancer with an X-ray. And so I said, you need a colonoscopy. And she called back, and she was told by her primary care doctor that because she was a senior, because there were so many younger people on the waiting list for a colonoscopy, you know, 11 months to get a colonoscopy, that she couldn't get one. She waited until she finally was hemorrhaging. She got to Vancouver General Hospital in an ambulance. 2 weeks later, she got her colonoscopy. But she died 2 weeks later from metastasized colon cancer. It is easier to ration care, and it's cheaper for the government to deny care, and particularly in our older population. And the same thing would happen here in Canada to our seniors if we have a complete government takeover, as Kamala Harris said, you know, we need to get rid of private insurance. We don't need that. Well, the same thing will happen in this country, and it'll be harmful to all of our citizens.
Well, Sally, it's just amazing. And I read maybe in your book that half the American population is on health, work-related health care, and another 20 million are buying their insurance on their own. So if these insurance companies are eliminated, that's how many people would have to go into the government system, which means doctors and nurses and all those machines we talk about, everybody competing and really nobody getting good care, unless you're important, like Mick Jagger. Sally Pipes is my guest, and we'll be right back after this. It's I guess we need to talk about what we can do, what we can expect here, and also equip all of you to know how to think about this and how to make the case. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Bernie Sanders put out a statement saying that a President Bernie Sanders would get Medicare for All through. He's pushing for filibuster reform, says it would get 51 votes. Democratic senators, quote, need to be prepared to do what polls show that rank-and-file Democrats want, and that is a Medicare for All single-payer system. Your reaction to that?
Not as long as I'm majority leader. It ought to be called Medicare for None, because as the setup piece pointed out, 180 million Americans would lose the private health insurance they, many of them, have negotiated for at work. Medicare itself, that current recipients have been paying into all these years, would be completely drained by adding all these additional people. If you want to turn America into a socialist country, this is the first step. That coupled, of course, with the Green New Deal, which would eliminate a whole lot of jobs. I think what we're seeing here is full socialism on display in the Democratic primaries for president. And even those who are skeptical about it, like Senator Klobuchar, are saying a public option. Well, that's not much different, because if you have a public option, I guarantee you the public option will also drive all the private insurance companies out of business. So look, this is a prescription for turning America into a Western European country.
Yeah, I think worse, actually. I think that probably doesn't capture it, because Western European countries, at least still like Britain, and even now Canada, is just beginning to talk about it, letting people buy private insurance or go somewhere else for their care. But if we implement this, there'll be no place to go. You want to go to Cuba for your medical care? You're not going to go to Canada. You'll have to get in line again. Or Britain. Really, honestly, this is so very serious. Sally Pipes is my guest. And Sally, of course, is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. Sally, let's go back to Obamacare, which passed, what, 10 years ago now? 10 years. I can't believe it.
Nine. Okay. March 23rd will be 10 of 2020. Yes.
Okay. As you have watched, and you certainly wrote about it and tracked it, and I think that's the last time you and I spoke on the air, what have you seen? How have you seen this thing evolve with Obamacare? How have you seen it affect America's medical care?
Well, President Obama, when he was the president, he said, you know, he wanted to have a health care bill that would reduce the cost of health care and have coverage for everybody. He said the average family under Obamacare would see its premiums go down by $2,500 a year. And his other statement, if you like your doctor and you like your insurance company, nothing will change. Well, you know, Sandy, we know that those things are not true. The American healthcare system was overturned with Obamacare for about 11 to 12 million people. It would have been cheaper for the American people to, it'd be cheaper if the government, you know, provided private insurance for those people instead of overturning the system for a system that the exchanges are not really working. You know, the average a family that bought an exchange plan, the premiums are very, very high. The average premium without a subsidy is $612 a month, and the deductibles tend to be, for a family of four, you know, up to $10,000-$11,000. Middle-class families cannot afford that. So even if they had an exchange plan under Obamacare, one of the metallic plans, in many cases they can't use it because they can't afford the deductible. And then another important point was that a lot of doctors would not take exchange coverage. So if you'd had a doctor and then you call for your appointment and you can't get an appointment because that doctor doesn't take the metallic plan, you know, you're out of luck, so unless you turn up at an emergency room. So premiums have been high, the deductibles are very high, and of course, you know, as I say, we only, you know, 10 to 11 million people, you know, are covered on the exchanges. So very expensive, and it didn't lead to universal coverage, and the cost is high.
Well, of course, we know that they actually wanted to throw us into universal coverage. That was the plan. But Sally, one thing I'm always confused about, I certainly know enough people who fit in the category you just described where the monthly premiums are killing them and then the deductibles are worse. It's to speak plainly, technically they've got a piece of paper that says they're covered, but they have to pay for it, and sometimes they can't get any kind of coverage because the doctors won't see them. So it's having a piece of paper saying you're insured means nothing if you can't actually get care. And that is really the bottom line for all of this. But then
I was just going to say in Canada, the just retired Madam Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin of the Canadian Supreme Court, in a decision, the Chiuli case back in 2006, about whether, you know, where can you act, when is a doctor in a doctor's office and when can he be paid? And as she said in her decision, access to a waiting list is not access to health care, and having a care card does not mean that you can get care. And this is very, I think it's a very important point that the American people need to realize.
Yeah, just because it says you're covered doesn't mean you'll get medical care. And it doesn't mean you don't have to pay for it either. Now, there is a category of people, it seems to me, and I want to ask, as I said, I know a lot of people that fall in the category we just described, but are there not lower income people, younger people, who are really loving Obamacare because they are getting coverage? Is there another category?
Well, I think the idea was with Obamacare that the president said, you know, that 28% of the young people, the young invincibles, I'm not in that group anymore, you know, would get exchange coverage. And so, and that would help to pay for the cost of health care. But what we found out was that the young invincible people, the people 18 to 31, did not buy coverage. They paid the individual mandate penalty of $695 or 2.5% of income because it was a lot cheaper than buying coverage. So the government did not get the funding from these young people to help support the older and sicker people who, you know, have more expensive coverage. So that just didn't work because young people don't want to spend $600 or $400 a month, $600 a month for coverage that they're probably not going to use. They have other things. So it turned out the young people were subsidizing the older and sicker people on the exchanges, but it wasn't enough. And now the individual mandate as of January 1st this year was eliminated. And so that's why one of the great things about the short-term limited duration plans, which under Obamacare in 2016 were reduced to 3 months of coverage, now, young people in particular are able to buy coverage for 12 months, renewable for up to 3 years. And for a lot of these people that are individuals not in the employer market, this is a great alternative for them. But people like Nancy Pelosi, people like Bernie Sanders, this is junk insurance. It's sabotaging healthcare. But people need choices. And the young people did not provide the kind of money to the government under Obamacare because they decided it was a bad deal for them.
Well, you know that the real hot button, and in fact, in that interview that I played with Mitch McConnell and Bret Baier, it was a long interview, and part of what he said, meaning McConnell, was assuring the American people that Republicans were all about covering pre-existing conditions. And again, Sally, for the reasons I just said, I just think government should not be, we should let the private sector, even the private sector, a charity, can figure that out, or I guess these exchanges. But I want to know what you think about that, because that's where people say, oh, wow, that's hard, and there's got to be some way to help those people get insurance. So what would be the solution?
Well, as you know, the Republicans had a full mandate in 2017 with holding the Senate, the House, and the presidency, and they had run on repealing and replacing Obamacare. By the fall of 2017, it just wasn't possible. McCain, was a problem on that, so they didn't do it. Then in the 2018 election, the Democrats took back the House. And I think the Republicans made a big mistake during that campaign, because the Democrats kept saying, you know, 120 million Americans with pre-existing conditions will lose their coverage and they won't be able to afford coverage. Well, the truth of the matter is that most of those people, except for about 6 million, most of those people with chronic pre-existing conditions are in the employer-based market, where 71% like their coverage, and they couldn't, under the law, they couldn't lose their coverage, or they couldn't have their premiums increase, you know, precipitously to high levels. So there really were only about 6 million people with pre-existing conditions in the individual market. The Republicans should have made that case and said, for those people with pre-existing conditions, the federal government could provide significant funding to each of the states to either establish or build up their high-risk pools so that these people could get good coverage for their conditions. It would take the pressure off younger people, and it's a great solution. Or the government could even just provide private coverage for these people, so that it would have been a lot cheaper. But instead, I think the Republicans lost the House because they didn't make the case of who are the people, how many people have pre-existing conditions, and that need to be cared for. And as I say, that number was about 6 million, not 120 million. So let's hope, as we go forward, you know, Senator McConnell has said this is single-payer is a far-left socialist experiment, and the Republicans need to, you know, come up with a plan probably after the 2020 election. I don't think anything's going to happen, even though Mr. Trump said we'll have a great plan before, but now they've pushed back on that. So I think for 2020, the Republicans really need to come up with a free market choice type of healthcare plan, which is what the American people would want. And we have, you know, Medicaid for low-income people. We have Medicare for our seniors. And Medicare, you know, which came into being in 1965 when the average American only lived to age 65, that age bracket should be bumped up. People like Warren Buffett should not even be eligible for Medicare. They can afford their own coverage. These programs should be there for those people who truly need them and can't afford coverage.
It's also, you talk a lot about the VA, and you say that is truly a single-payer system. A lot of veterans listen to this show, and they probably know what you're talking about, but explain to others why that has not worked.
Well, I mean, under the Veterans Administration, I was debating Uwe Reinhardt. He unfortunately passed away, but he's a professor of economics at Princeton, and he interrupted my presentation a few years ago and said, we have an example of a single-payer system in this country, and it works very well. And I said, well, Uwe, what is that? And he said, it's the VA. But, you know, the problem with the VA is it is a government single-payer system, and our vets who have served our country are, in many cases, are subject to long waits for care. Care is rationed. A lot of the newest pharmaceuticals are not on the formulary for our vets, and in many cases, they have to travel under TRICARE long distances to get to see a doctor or get a treatment at a VA hospital. So, you know, our vets know what single-payer means and how harmful it is to them, because the care is rationed and there are long waits. And so our vets need to step up. I mean, there's a push for privatizing the Veterans Administration, and it should happen, but it keeps being delayed. But it would make the care that our vets get by having HMOs, PPOs, allowing them to get private coverage would be so much better for them and their health.
You know, the other thing we've not even touched on is what's happening in medical schools. You know, it's my understanding that young doctors are now being sort of propagandized themselves into thinking that single payer is better. And a lot of the old doctors have been retiring early because of the rules and regulations and paperwork. So how could that be addressed, Sally?
Well, certainly under Senator Sanders' plan, one plan, his latest plan in his 2017 bill, doctors would be paid at Medicare rates, i.e. 40% below what they get treated for treating private patients. You're absolutely right. A lot of docs in their 50s retired early because of Obamacare, because of the mandates, the regulations, electronic health records. We will see a lot more doctors retire early if we get single payer. The American Association of Medical Colleges has predicted by 2030 there would be a shortage of 131,000 doctors. And more important, within the American Medical Association now, which only represents 16% of doctors in this country, not all docs, but there is a division called Physicians for National Health Insurance and now Students for National Health Insurance. And I believe that the best and brightest kids who traditionally have gone into medicine in this country, it's very competitive, will not go into medicine if they think they're going to be, you know, a union member. Their salaries would be limited by rates paid to doctors for treating Medicare patients. And so their ability to practice the kind of medicine that they would like to practice would be very limited. So it would destroy, as I say, the best and brightest young people going into medicine who would then become the best doctors, as we see, whether it's at Mass General in Massachusetts, at New York Presbyterian, at UCSF, all of these medical institutions which have fantastic doctors.
Yes, so the bottom line is, you and I, Americans, those listening, we have to really make sure that we know what we're talking about by this. We do encourage our senators and congressmen not to move to the left on health care. Open market solutions, freedom, 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 and competition, the American way, no single payer, no Medicare for all, and show Bernie Sanders in the polls and in the ballot box how you feel about this. My guest, Sally Pipes, thank you for listening. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.